Blog Talk Radio.
We're a nation of haters under their control. To rise up everybody and burn down, burn down. The system fails, the exit rules. Wake up the silence, maturity.
Welcome to another great edition of the Star Chamber Show. I am Sayla Janelle, and Alex Brown is with me tonight hosting. We've got just a few announcements to go over before we get to our lovely guest tonight. First off, if you have not heard about Imaginarium, if you don't know what this is, if you don't know anything about it, go to entertheimaginarium.com. This is a great, great writing and book convention. You want to be there if you have an interest in genre, if you have an interest in writing. Panels, workshops, great guests, too much to talk about in a short amount of time. So go to the site, check it out. Seven Star Press has had some great releases recently. E. Chris Garrison just put out Blue Spirit, and R.J. Sullivan just put out Darkness with a Chance of Whimsy. Both are great titles. You should definitely check those out. I know the ebooks are available for both, and I think the paperback for Blue Spirit has just become available as well. Let me see what else. There's a few, some really exciting news in the world of literature that just popped up that I saw today that I wanted to bring up since we are, you know, a book and writing podcast. This is really a big drive forward for preservation of free speech, especially in England. I don't know who all has seen the article. This comes courtesy, I saw it on Alexander Christian's feed today. Pianist James Rhodes won the right to publish his autobiography. Part of the problem, not problem, but part of the issue with that case is his ex-wife wanted to bar the putting out of that autobiography because he had some very violent cases of abuse done to him as a child, and she was concerned about how that would affect their child, apparently. There is a Victorian-era law that apparently was a sticking point for this, and thankfully, he has won this case. So he gets to publish his autobiography. He gets to tell his story. Things like this are so important, and we'll probably try to put the link to this up on the page later because this is just really, really an interesting topic to look into. Also, and on a more, well, that was positive, but on a more slightly later note, also very cool, 500 new fairy tales have just been discovered in Germany. This is brand new, like never been published. These are from the collection gathered by historian Franz Xaver von Schoenwerth. He's actually probably the most, or the biggest collector besides the Grimm brothers. The Grimm brothers actually thought very highly of him. Where he differs from the Grimm brothers is that he never edited his stories. The Grimm brothers watered theirs way down, if you can believe that. He really strove for accuracy and to preserve the local different quirks of these stories. So these are the real deal, and they have been tucked away in an archive for over 150 years. I don't know if there are plans for publication or even translation yet. I will try to put the link up on the page to that as well, because this is so cool. Things like this just don't happen every day. So really, really cool. And Alex, you had something you wanted to talk about, didn't you?
Well, yeah, actually, pretty much with all the great news that you just gave, this is going to be kind of a little sad news, actually. A week ago today, the artist James Powell was killed by a drunk driver. And for those of you who do not know James Powell, he was a very big hand in a lot of the conventions on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, as well as Alabama Gulf Coast and the Florida Keys area. And he is also the artist who did the cover art for my novel, Cerinthia Falls. We had known each other for about a good 7 years, and in that time had become pretty good friends. And for the books that are out there that do have his artwork as their cover, those are books that I'm sure the authors will forever cherish, as well as the family and friends of that artist will cherish. And so I just wanted to say that I would like for this show to definitely be in his honor. He was really strong in the horror community, the steampunk community, and dystopian community. So I know that he would really enjoy tonight's show.
That's awesome. That's I remember I saw about that on your post as well as a few other people's, and that really, I've seen the name passed around, and that really took me by surprise. So that's just, it's tragic, definitely. But I'm sure we'll do him proud tonight, definitely.
Oh, definitely. Completely agreed. But yes, besides that, I am just peddling my little way through Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, bringing in a lot of new followers, telling people, buy my books, buy Southern Haunt, buy Cerinthia Falls, buy Traumatized, and also, the best news I've had all week, Southern Haunts 3 is finally off of my table and onto the table of the publisher. So, yay.
Awesome.
I can work on new things.
Huzzah. You just reminded me because I totally forgot to promote myself. gosh, love how that works. I'm actually doing a mini event with Bitten by Books this Friday on the Facebook discussion group. If you join the discussion group on Facebook, we're going to have a post, and I think I am going to be giving away a copy of Old School in print, so you can have my lovely signature on that for you. And there's been rumor that maybe everyone who comments will maybe get to come away with an ebook copy of Lost in the Shadows. So you guys should definitely come by and check that out because, you know, I'm just going to be like Oprah and prizes for everybody. apparently, I'm in a good
mood
this week.
So. You get a car.
Yeah. Well, we can do ebooks. I'm not to the car level yet. Everybody gets an ebook.
Hey, you know, to some people, myself included, that's a lot better than a car. So, yeah.
There you go. That's very kind of you to pity me like that. Anywho, all right. But yeah, I definitely, I'm very proud of you for Southern Haunts 3. That's exciting. It's very.
Thank you.
Very, very
and,
cool.
And I'll be writing a blog on that pretty soon. I'm thoroughly convinced that book 3 was cursed, and so it's going to be a blog about how I believe cursed. So.
Okay.
Watch out for that.
Well, you are. I definitely will. And you had better come on my blog and talk about it, too. So, because you know I love having you. Awesome sauce.
Oh.
All right.
Yes.
We got a guest, don't we?
Yes. And would you love to announce this awesome lady?
Sure. Our guest tonight is someone who is new on the scene but has become fairly talked about lately. We first became aware of her at Imaginarium last year. She is the author of the steampunk book Gears of Golgotha. So could we please have a big Star Chamber welcome for Becca McAuliffe, please. And I guess I have to move her over because, hello.
There we go.
There we go.
Hey, are you there, Rebecca?
Hey, Rebecca.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, whoa! Okay, sorry, my phone. And thank you for, you got my name right. No one ever gets my name right. If I had a dollar for every time somebody messed up my name, I wouldn't have to pay for college.
You and me both, sister. I'm the same way.
So how are you guys doing tonight?
Surviving. Doing good. We got some nasty weather here, and so we're just enjoying the chat, and I'm staying in from all that rain.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
Yeah. Sorry. I get a little tongue-tied easy, so if I start stuttering, I apologize.
Oh, no,
no
problem. We definitely can roll the punches.
Okay. All right. Thank you. But thanks again for letting me come on here. This is great. Thank you again, by the way.
No problem.
Not a problem.
It was nice meeting you at last year's Imaginarium, and will you be returning to this year's Imaginarium?
Yeah. Yes, I will. And hopefully I'll be there with my next book. Yeah, I'll be there with... Huh?
What would the next book be titled?
The next book is called Alpha. It's book one of the Alpha trilogy. It's basically think Bourne Saga meets Manchurian Candidate.
Nice.
Very cool.
Nice.
Interesting. Sounds very high adrenaline.
Mhm.
All right. Well.
Huh?
No, I was going to say, before we talk about what you've got in the future, we want to catch our listeners up because they may not all have heard of you, so we want to definitely let them hear all about you. So I was looking online today about Gears of Golgotha. So the Amazon description for it hints at the overall world and a little bit of the story, but it's still pretty mysterious. So, you know, this is Gears of Golgotha is your first book. So what actually is it about? Can you sort of give us a hint into the actual story about it?
Pretty much, it's 1,000 years after the Third World War, and all of the entire Earth is united under one world government called New Pangaea. And there's a caste system with two classes. You have mages that practice magic, and chemists that are essentially scientists. And the work of New Pangaea revolves around the gears. And these are these large machines, satellites, that orbit the Earth that provide power to the entire planet. Like, you ever seen those old cartoons where the faster the hamster wheel goes, the more power you get?
Yeah.
It's same basic principle. And the main character is a girl named Erin, and she comes from a long line of chemists. Now, an important thing to remember is that in this world, what your parents do is what you do. You can't switch. You can't do both. You pretty much got to do what your family does. Anyway, Erin meets Dr. Maxwell Sharp, and he's the man in charge of the Golgotha Project, which is the group that maintains and protects the gears. And from there, things just get crazy. There's government conspiracy. There's a little bit of action that's kind of reminiscent to Mortal Kombat. I like the fight scene I wrote. I was writing, and I was like, huh, this kind of reminds me of Mortal Kombat. But there's mystery to who Erin really is, where she really comes from, what is the true purpose of the gears and of the Golgotha Project? What is that true purpose? And it's gotten 4 and 5 star reviews on Amazon. A couple of days ago, someone posted on the Gears of Golgotha Facebook page saying that it was one of the best books that they had read in a long time. And I've had people come up to me. It was kind of funny because of the ending. I had a book signing at the Fuzzy Duck, which is a bookstore in Moorhead, Kentucky. And I was walking to ADUC, which is like the center of Moorhead State University's campus, to get Starbucks, and I hear, "You! I got a bone to pick with you! That ending!" Sorry, I tend to go off on tangents.
Hey, it's fine. Go for it. And, you know, that's the beauty of it, you know, it allows us to see how the situation really is, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Well, I have a question for you.
Yes?
With Gears of Golgotha, I said that correct, right?
Yes.
Okay. With Gears of Golgotha, it seems to play on a lot of themes in post-apocalyptic and dystopian young adult literature that are popular right now. What makes Gears stand out more from other dystopian or apocalyptic stories? I know that you've already kind of given us a background about what the basis is, but what type of characters can we see? What stands out from everything else?
Mostly, I think it's the characters that you encounter in the Golgotha Project, and the bonds that you encounter with all of the characters. Like Aaron's parents, I really, and honestly, their relationship that was in the inspired by mine and my parents. I mean, I see my parents in Aaron's parents. And I think those bonds are really what makes it stand out. Like, you develop, honestly, the relationships they grow and develop just like in real life. And I feel like that's just where I feel like my personal strength is characters. But that's just me.
All right. Exactly. A lot of times it is the character that you have to rely upon that makes it stand out from the other titles.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I wrote and I think also with Erin, when I was writing her at the time, I was writing Gears of Golgotha right after I had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, so that kind of inner struggle that she has really is really kind of reminiscent of my journey. Honestly, Gears is a journey. It's a journey of not only finding yourself but accepting what you find. And that was a journey that I had to go through that I went through while I was writing it. But I mean, that's what you experience in college. You find yourself in college, but then it's a matter of accepting what you find, because what you find may scare you, frighten you. Maybe there's some things that you want to change, and that's okay. But just accepting yourself is so important, and I think that's something that a lot of people overlook. And I want to be able to take my readers on that journey with me.
That's a very commendable thing. I mean, I think that helps an author connect with people if they really come from a true emotional place. So that's very valiant. Now, I know you've been described all over online as a steampunk author, but, you know, in reading about your work, it seems to carry more of a heavy dystopian post-apocalyptic influence. So what exactly makes Gears of Golgotha steampunk?
It was actually kind of a funny story. I originally did not intend for Gears to be steampunk. Several people read it and they said, "Oh, this is very steampunk," and I was like, and pretty much what happened was originally I had described it as sci-fi dystopia with a little touch of fantasy, and they honestly, I know that sounds like an awful answer, but to be quite honest, pretty much almost everyone that's read it has talked about it being steampunk, and I was just, okay, I guess I'll just run with it. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Let's see.
I have another question for her. Did you have anything else you wanted to throw at her before I ask this?
No, you can go. You can go with it.
Okay, cool. As a steampunk writer, do you see the genre coming to it? Into its own the way urban fantasy is, or remaining more of its own little niche? How do you see that? Do you think that we're going to go in bookstores one day and just see like nothing but a steampunk area, such as how they do sci-fi or romance? I know a few independent stores are doing it, but I don't think the mainstream has caught on yet.
honestly, I think steampunk is an acquired taste. It may seem a little, it may strike some as a little strange when you first see it, but then it takes, like I said, it's an acquired taste. But honestly, it may depend honestly, only time will tell whether or not we'll see like our own, whether people will see whether steampunk will have its own section in Barnes & Noble. That's honestly an answer that no one can predict. Because at this point, the steampunk, it's an acquired taste, I think.
Well, that's good points, definitely. And, you know, things like this change and evolve on the market so rapidly that, you know, it's really hard to say. We're just always curious about subgenres and niche things like that and their evolution, so that's probably why, you know, we were just curious. But one thing that I noticed is a theme of your book seems to be magic versus science with the mages and the chemists and their conflict. So how does that overall part of the plot reflect your own beliefs and ideals? Because this really seems like it borders on, you know, touching on the idea of faith versus science a little bit.
Actually, that whole plot point kind of came from the era of early development, where Gears of Golgotha was originally intended to be a commentary on the science versus religion debate. At the time, it was a few months after the debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye, I believe it was. Yeah, wait.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I keep getting my years mixed up. I do know that debate was a huge influence on it, because I'm actually an education major, and I'm always for teaching and learning. And then you see these people where it's like, oh no, we don't want to, no, stop. And I was really kind of influenced between that kind of conflict. When really, I think Erin described that, at least towards the end of the novel, when her character starts to develop, which will continue to develop in the sequel, which is still kind of has a to be announced release date. But anyway, she was kind of like the balance to where both of those ideals are important. And then honestly, it evolved into more of a personal journey. But that kind of that important ideal kind of stuck with it.
No, I think that's interesting. I mean, ideas definitely evolve, and that's just, you know, when I see things like that, it always kind of makes me wonder if things do come from, like, either something you see in the real world or something that's on your mind. So, no, that's very interesting.
I agree. And, you know, I was kind of looking over some of your reviews, and I noticed that there was a lot of comments about how relentless and fast-paced your book is. How important is pacing to a story, and how do you balance that with your character development? Because I know that you said your character development was very strong, and that was one of your – I'm not saying that you only have a few high points at the book, but I'm saying that's one of your many high points that you had described was your character development.
Honestly, mostly I didn't intend for it to be fast-paced. I honestly thought that at some point I was going too slow, but I was really anxious. When I was writing it, I was kind of anxious about, oh my gosh, this is my first book. People are going to be looking, honestly, I never let people look at my writing before. It was always like, obviously when it came to like writing papers for class, that'd be one thing, but I mean, writing my short stories on my computer, I mean, I would never let anyone look at it. Like not even my best friends, they would never see my stuff. And I guess when I was writing it, knowing that I had the full intention of releasing it, I guess that kind of made me really anxious. And I guess that influenced the pacing. But pacing is, I think fast paced is good depending on what genre you're in and what the moment calls for. I mean, you can't just gloss over like, I know this seems like a little irrelevant, but it does have a point. When I was watching Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, and they completely glossed over the Elwood brothers' mother's death, and it's like, no, that's an important emotional point. You gotta talk about it. But the first few episodes were so fast paced. So honestly, when it comes to pacing, when it comes to adrenaline filled situations, kind of like a fight sequence, or like your heart pounding because it's like, oh my gosh, there's this mystery. Oh crap, what's gonna happen? But when there's an emotional moment, like if a character is having a huge breakdown, or if there's another just huge emotion that's kind of just coming off the page and making the reader feel something, you don't just want to gloss over it. It's really important. I guess pacing, it honestly depends on the genre and what the moment calls for.
No, that's very telling. I mean, you're right. You know, sometimes you just have to go with what's best for the story. So I think that's a very important point. There's talk, I've also noticed when I was going through the reviews today earlier, a lot of people mentioned a big plot twist in Gears they didn't see coming. So how important in a story like this, you know, we've talked about pacing and character development, how important is it to have a plot twist in something like this?
I think plot twists are, honestly, I guess it's not, but they're fun. They're fun to read, fun to write. Pretty much, it's kind of like the writer kind of, how do I put this? I guess I'm just an awful person because I like it when my readers throw the book and cry.
That's always a big compliment. No, I always think that's always a big compliment. So, hey, that's awesome.
Like, I am one of my readers. She either said she cried 3 times and threw the book 4 times, or she cried 4 times and threw the book 3 times.
Nice.
I mean, I guess I'm just evil because I like watching my readers. I like being able to tug at the heartstrings because it shows that, I guess it kind of makes me feel like that you can get invested in these characters and in this story. Because with a lot of the things that I write, it's almost always a commentary of sorts, or a personal, or like chronicling a personal journey. I mean, with Alpha, my next book, it's going about the concept of loyalty, and how far will you go to protect what you love. Really. I guess it kind of shows that they're being impacted by what I'm saying, that they're kind of keeping that kind of commentary in mind whenever they go about their daily life.
Now, with the plot twist, this is something that always fascinates me when there's a big plot twist. When you wrote it, was there concern to not make it obvious what the twist was in advance? How were you able to skate around on thin ice to avoid the twist? Was there hints leading to it? How did that come to be?
Funny story.
And also, like, what was your mindset as you were writing that? Like, what were you stressing out over? Oh, my God, am I giving away too many clues? Am I giving away too few clues?
Honestly, I can't remember. I know that there's, like, 2 terms, plotter and pantser. I don't remember which one's the one that where you just, like, go with the flow. I get those confused a lot. But honestly, I just go with the flow. I mean, literally, it's like, okay, this is good. No, this is not okay. What are you doing? Honestly, I didn't see it coming. But that's just where the story led up to. I guess kind of just the way that Dr. Sharp behaved around Aaron. Kind of the mystery of like why, honestly, why that some things just made people uncomfortable. Like I said, I didn't see it coming either. It just happened. That's just how the story ended up. when I wrote it, I was like, okay, let's go with this. All right, huh? What? I can't even right now.
And, you know, I can relate to that. That's happened with one or two short stories of mine that I wrote. Well, more so novellas, really.
Now, there's... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's okay.
All right, well, I know Gears of Golgotha started out as a self-published title, but then it was picked up by Hydra Publications after Imaginarium. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about and why you chose to change over to small press over just remaining self-published?
Funny story, just a little funny story before that. I know I keep saying that, I'm sorry. But I lost the last 5 chapters before Imaginarium, like, started, so I had to write those and then rewrite pretty much the whole ending, and then I took it there. I only brought, like, 10 books. I was like, you know, I'm a new author. No one's going to take a chance on me. And then I made friends with a lot of the authors there. I remember I was so nervous. I had Missy Goodman lead me around to talk to people, like, she literally, like, had me by the hand and just introduced me to some of the authors. And then the weekend went on. I sold out on the second day. Well, I thought I'd sold out. It turns out there was one more. And then on the third day, Frank Hall bought it. But I made friends with Frank Hall, and he was working security, I believe. My memory's really bad, so if I mess anything up, I apologize. Anyway... he had bought, a lot of people had buying, had bought, apparently a lot of people liked it. So they, originally what had happened was that, I was pitching my next book, Alpha, to Pro Se. And they wanted it, and then another publishing house, and then another publishing house, and then Hydra. But Hydra actually wanted to take both Alpha and Gears. So I went with Hydra I really liked Tony and just all the authors there, and their offer was great, I felt like I was where I wanted to be. And it was an accomplishment for me. Because I've been wanting to be published for God knows how long now. And I felt like I finally made it at Imaginarium.
Wow.
I mean, obviously there's a lot more I can learn and a lot more I can do. But I had definitely taken a huge step in the right direction by signing with Hydra.
Okay, awesome. Well, when writing a book, it takes up a lot of energy and time. I mean, you can somewhat kiss your social life goodbye, you can kiss sleep goodbye, and it takes a lot out of you to write a book. How do you balance that while being a student?
Honestly, it takes a lot of work. I'm also not only a college, I'm also a member of a Sigma Alpha Iota International Music Fraternity, so I'm also a member of a Greek organization. I write whenever I can. Usually, most of my writing I do over the weekend. I'll go to there's a bookstore right off the campus of Moorhead State called the Fuzzy Duck, and it has a bookstore in the back called Coffee Tree.
Mm-hmm.
I had book signing there last month. They're great people. But anyway, I go there on Fridays and Saturdays. I'll get a smoothie and a sandwich sometimes I'll get a coffee, their coffee. Oh, my God, their coffee. Oh, my God. But anyway, just if you ever get to Moorhead, you need to go there. Like, you need to. You can't leave Moorhead without going there or Smoky Valley. Sorry. Anyway.
Well, I know where to get coffee.
But I take my laptop there. I'll sit there. I'll write. Whenever I go home for breaks, I usually try to visit my cousin Amy, the author of Letters to Daniel, at least once. Because I actually get a lot done there. I think my record while staying the night at her house was a little under 3,000 words.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of the time it's during weekends and breaks and then in the afternoons. I can't really get as much done during, like, Monday through Friday because I'm taking 18 credit hours, too. and then I'll also have an internship. So, yeah, no sleep for me. Oh, well, I'll sleep when I'm dead.
Oh, I remember those days. It only gets more fun from there, I hate to tell you. Oh, man, there are days I long for school because it was so much easier. Oh, man. Anywho, that's awesome. You've been really consistent, though, with store appearances and events, like what you were talking about, and I know you've been to some different stuff. We were at the book fair together, and you've done these store events. I think you just did a Barnes & Noble appearance a few days ago, or like last week. That's sometimes really difficult for new authors to get those, you know, booked. I know, like, even for, you know, those of us who are a little bit further along, like Alex and I mean, it's sometimes hard for us to get stores to let us book with them and things like that. So how do you go about getting your appearances, being such a new author?
Actually, I have Tony to thank for that. Tony was the one who scheduled the Barnes & Noble appearance and helped schedule the Fuzzy Duck appearance. I had talked to the owners beforehand about possibly doing it, but I'm actually new to this, so I didn't really know the process of, like, how do I go about calling people? It's definitely a learning experience right now. Like, honestly, I just have to thank Tony Acree, the owner of Hydra, for helping me get these appearances, and Frank Hall for helping me get to the Author's Fair, and Amy for helping me get to Imaginarium last year. Honestly, the appearances, like I said, honestly, I couldn't have done anything without those people. Because I'm wanting to do a lot more appearances in the future. I want to go back to Barnes & Noble. I want to go back to the Fuzzy Duck. Definitely Imaginarium, obviously. Author's Fair next year. Any other place that'll take me. I definitely want to make more appearances, especially during the summer. Because I'm probably not going to be able to do as much because of my internship next fall. Actually, funny story, I got a school excuse to go to Imaginarium. I usually can get school excuses for things, for big conventions like Imaginarium. I can't use them every other weekend, obviously, but if need be, I can do that. But definitely everyone who's ever helped me, honestly, I couldn't have gotten anywhere without just a huge support group. My sisters have been a huge support. My family, my boyfriend, they've all just been a huge support, and I wouldn't have gotten anywhere without any of them.
Yeah, you definitely
touched on that. Definitely important. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we've spoken about what inspired your work, and we have also spoken about how you got transitioned over from self-publishing to being represented by a small house. And we've also heard about how you've been introduced to different signing areas and so forth. But about promoting yourself. How do you do some of the self-promotion? Because a lot of writing and even getting published with a small and medium house, yeah, the small and medium house do help you, but also at the same time, you need to do a lot of advertisement on your own. And it doesn't necessarily have to be paid advertisement. It can be social media. And so I was just curious what forms of advertisement you utilize or what types of social media you utilize.
Well, I have a Twitter. I have a Facebook page for just my author stuff, and then I have Facebook pages for Gears and for the Alpha Trilogy. I have Twitter. I have an Instagram, I have a website and a blog, but for some odd reason, for like 3 weeks, Weebly was down or something, so I wasn't able to update it as much, so it might not be up to date. I'll be fixing that probably right after this. I don't like technology. This computer hates me. I don't know why. But pretty much, when I go about promotion, I don't want to be the annoying salesman. I want to come across as a friend. I mean, when I meet someone new at a convention, I'll just be like, "Hi, how you doing?" Or I'll ask them a question. Or I'm into fandom, Supernatural, Doctor Who. If they're wearing a Doctor Who shirt, I'm like, "Dude, get over here! I love your shirt. Who is your favorite Doctor?" And then we'll get into this huge discussion about sci-fi and different books. And then from there, you transition into the books. I mean, and a lot of actually, believe it or not, on my social media, quite a bit of it is more, honestly, works also more, not necessarily a personal social media account per se, but it also, but it does kind of function that way, because you want to come across as a friend, not as an annoying, not necessarily as a salesman in general, but like an annoying salesman, kind of like the, I don't know, but you want to just come across as someone who's not arrogant. Someone that's like, "Hey, just check out my stuff. If you like it, great. And if you don't, that's okay. Thanks for checking it out anyway." That was something that I wanted. That was an approach that I think has worked, because I sold out at every event I've been to, except for Barnes & Noble, where I brought 30 books, sold 24, and then the store bought the last 6 to put on their shelf.
That is wow. That's good. That shows what happens when you present yourself as a friend versus someone who's like just making the whole situation about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading the book The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer, and it's absolutely amazing. And that's one of the things that she really tries to establish with her fan base is more of a friendship versus more of a buy my work sort of deal. And so
yeah.
I think that that's the correct way to approach it in any form, may it be new friends that you make online or friends that you make in person.
Yeah, quite a few of my fans, I've actually like grown become friends with too. I mean, this one writer that I met at the author's fair, we started talking about each other's writing. Now we're on Facebook, and now we're friends on Facebook. One of the girls who had heard about my book from a friend of hers, turns out we're both fraternity sisters in the same province. She's at the NKU chapter, and I was the Moorhead State chapter. So, but yeah, it was. I definitely like the friendship, kind of approach, because you support your friends. I mean, that's what friends do. You support each other, and you're there for each other. And for me, support means equals buy books. And I mean, I just have friends who have friends who have friends, and then just travels word by mouth. I mean, you don't want to be arrogant. You want to be confident, but you don't want to be arrogant. Does that make sense?
It does. Yes. You want to be confident about your work, but you don't want to boast by saying, I'm the best there is, there's nothing better than me, and, you know, just rambling on and on and on, where it's not a conversation, it's a one-sided self-glorification, you know. We actually have a question from Twitter. One of our guests on Twitter has asked, they are curious about what your influences are as a writer. Could you give us some of your influences?
Honestly, I really didn't start thinking about my influences until I actually, like, got published. At first I thought I was, like, doing my own thing, but then looking back, I was definitely in, at least the darkness kind of in my stories, especially the ones that hadn't been, that have not been released, that I actually want to kind of remaster and hopefully get out there someday. I kind of feel like I'm kind of inspired by the Bronte sisters with their characters and their darkness. With some of my darker stories, I like to think Edgar Allan Poe. He's a big influence. For Alpha, John le Carré. J.K. Rowling was even a big influence for Gears. And Suzanne Collins. Those were definitely some of my influences. And Amy McCorkle. My cousin, authors that I've met, whatever I read, it almost kind of shapes my thinking. It's like, oh, I never thought about this that way. And I think that's the goal of every writer.
Let me ask you this, because I know that you had mentioned Amy a few times in our show tonight. And I know that you and her are pretty close. Have y'all ever had the opportunity just to sit down with one another and do nothing but just write beside each other, throwing off ideas and, you know, talking as you're writing? Do y'all have that kind of opportunity?
Definitely. That's actually what I meant earlier, talking about how whenever I would go over to her house, that's actually what kind of like what we do during our visits. Like when I was first writing Gears, I had the premise set up, but I didn't know what genre to do. I didn't know where to take it. I mean, I just kept on bouncing off ideas from Amy, and I just kept on bouncing off ideas back and forth. And I think we influence each other's writing. I'd like to think so. I don't know, but we'll stay up till like 2 a.m. I'll drink I think my record was like a 5 cups of coffee and then about 3,000 words, I guess. Yeah, all of the coffee. I leave there and I just go back to my room and I sleep.
Well, I know a lot of people enjoy your work, obviously, so a lot of what you're doing is definitely working for you. So one thing I've noticed is that the question a lot of people seem to be asking is there going to be a sequel to Gears of Golgotha? And, you know, what can we expect next from you?
Yes, there will be a sequel to Gears. I can guarantee you that. However, due to my schooling and Alpha, that's the book I'm currently working on. Actually, I have a contract for that. I'm worrying about Alpha at the moment. So once Alpha's out, when I figure out like where the rest of the trilogy is going, I will start work on the sequel. The working title right now is Golgotha's Redemption. That's the working title. I can't guarantee that'll be the title, like if or when it's released. But yes, there will be a sequel. And then Alpha will be out ideally in September, if not near the end of this year.
Very cool.
Now, we're getting to about our 10-minute mark before the show is over, and so this is where I would like to ask one of our most important questions, and I say it's most important because all of us know how it is to go from just having that manuscript without it having a home, and then all of a sudden it does have a home. What is some of the best advice you can give other authors out there who is still sitting on their manuscript and it hasn't found a home yet?
Well, honestly, just some advice in general, never stop writing. There was just this sad story. My younger sister, some author had visited her middle school, and she was and she had brought part of her story that she was writing to the meeting, and she said, "Hey, what do you think of this idea? What should I do?" The author made the mistake of telling her, "Don't do anything. That sounds stupid. It sounds too much like Red Dawn." And from there, pretty much it almost crushed her dream of writing, and she's only just now starting to write again. Don't let anyone tell you to do that. Never stop writing. Don't listen to anyone that tries to tell you otherwise, and if they do, then you don't need that negativity in your life. Just be proactive. I mean, make connections, make friends. That's honestly one of the reasons why I use the friendship approach when I market myself, because I also want to help up-and-coming writers. I want to, like, be there and say, "Hey, I know this person. Hey, I know this convention you can go. I know you can go to Imaginarium. Hey, this publisher this publishing house is open for submissions. You should totally send it in." Make connections, make friends, and be proactive. Never let anyone tell you you can't do something.
Completely agree.
Always good. Yep, definitely. Very, very important.
I mean, honestly,
I was saying go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was going to say, like, if I ever meet that author, I want that author to apologize, whoever it was. I don't remember her name, but whoever it was, I want her to personally apologize to that girl. I want her to apologize because she pretty much almost crushed her dream. You can't do that. As an author, you're a role model. You become a role model. J.K. Rowling and Suzanne Collins, they've all become, I mean, I'm not saying I'm as good as them. No. But anyway, like, oh gosh, sorry. Like, anyway, as an author, you become a role model. You all are role models. So you got to hold up that standard. And I'm sorry. This subject kind of just gets me really riled up and passionate. So I'm just all like,
No, passion is good. I mean, I think one of the things for me in the arts, because I've done performance work and I've worked as a costume designer for, like, I don't know, 15 or 16 years, and I've been writing for years now. One of the things that I think people really, really need is, you know, they need to know that they just have to keep working. And no matter whether you're J.K. Rowling or Sailor Janelle or Alexander Brown or Rebecca McAuliffe, you matter, and your work matters. And, you know, standing up for your work, for your creativity, is important. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
Yeah, and that's the number one thing with the business. I mean, you have to have a thick skin for it, because the thing is, if you don't have a thick skin, you're not going to make it. And I say this because before I was published, I'm saying, like, when I was 20, 21 years old, I didn't even have a title out to my name. I was just writing for myself and was sharing with friends and family. Out of the negative responses that I received, had I taken that to heart, I wouldn't be where I am editing an anthology, throwing novels out there, working on a new novel, so on and so forth. So, I mean, you're going to get that negative criticism.
Back when I was in high school and I was more of a theater music major, that's what I was leaning for. I mean, I only wrote, quietly for fun, whatever. But, I mean, I was told at one point that I wasn't strong enough to do entertainment and it would never happen. Now, I mean, am I on Broadway? No, but I have only had to work retail once in my 16-year career. I've worked in the field that entire time. So, I mean, you have to just keep going. And you have to be smart about it, and you may not always get, you know, at the highest level, but it's possible, you know? And that's why I think people, you really have to prepare people that they are just going to have to just keep fighting and keep, if that's what you want to do, you have to be prepared to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The very first thing that I do when I receive criticism is I ask myself, well, would this person be a jealous person and say something out of hate? If that person is not a jealous person and would just say something out of hate, then I have to ask myself, okay, well, maybe I need to inquire about what needs to be fixed and see a little bit more of their
right.
perspective. And at that point, it becomes constructive criticism, of course.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, at some point, too, it's publishing, I always say, is kind of like dating. I mean, you could have the best manuscript in the world, or you could be on your best A game at the nicest restaurant, and if you just don't click with a person, or if they're just not into your work, you know, that's okay. It doesn't mean
yeah.
it's a tragic event. You know, it just wasn't meant to be, and you move on, and you go date the next person, or you go submit to the next people. You know, there's no harm in that, and you should never feel bad about that.
Exactly, and sometimes when, like, let's say, for example, let's say that you're a publisher, Selah, and I'm pitching my novel to you, and we have enjoyed a friendship, and so on and so forth, and then you come to me and say, the novel is awful, it's not what I'm looking for, but we can still be friends. Yeah, that's very true. We can still be friends. I mean, just because you didn't like the genre of which I gave you or the theme
right.
of which I gave you doesn't mean that someone else is going to feel that same way about it. And even then, the publishers that I met, I had the opportunity to come into them from a friendship perspective. And just because
right,
I came
yes.
into them with a friendship perspective doesn't mean that I had anything just given to me. I had to work for what
no.
I have. And because the thing
yeah.
is, you have to build a person's respect as a friend. That's regardless.
Yes.
And then
anyone will tell you, yeah, I mean, when I definitely try to keep a friendship perspective with, you know, colleagues and publishers and the like, but anyone will tell you very much so when I am business, I am all business, and that is what I'm laser
exactly.
focused on, and that is what, and I don't mean anything personal by it. I am very aggressive on the business side. I will never, ever deny that. I am, but it's because I really believe in the quality of the product. So, but that gets, I mean, that's that, you know, that's not necessarily all who I am as a person, but that's how I handle my business in the creative field.
Exactly. And that's where the line comes in of such as this is a friendship, this is business. I remember the first time I ever had any story of mine picked up by a publisher. It was the story, The Third Eye, which is in Dreams of Steam Volume 2, edited by Kimberly Richardson and published by Dark Oak Press. Even though I had known them as a friend prior to, I still knew I had to bust my butt and make something
yep.
good, or it would be denied. And that's how it is when people send submissions to me.
Yeah.
It's like, if I know you as a friend, that's great, but if your story's
yeah.
not cut for it, it's not.
Well, not to cut you off, but we have like a minute left. I want to make sure Rebecca gets released.
Okay.
We should really,
yeah.
we'll talk to Stephen because we should do a show about this, about people's different experiences and business advice like this, I think. This would be a good 4-hour topic. But Rebecca, where can people find you online? Where can they get your books at?
Well, I'm on Twitter. It's at Becca Loves Music, B-E-K-A-H. Loves Music. I know it's a weird spelling. Like I said at the beginning of the show, if I had a dollar for every time, blah, 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 blah. I'm also on Facebook with Rebecca McAuliffe, author, blogger. There's also links to the pages for Gears of Golgotha and the Alpha Trilogy. The Alpha Trilogy is not out yet, but Gears is. You can find that on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if they haven't run out yet, the Barnes & Noble in the Summit in Louisville is carrying them on the shelf. I also have an Instagram. It's Rebecca M_author. and it's R-E-B-E-K-A-H. I also have a website, Rebecca McCall.